I'd like to ask a question today and then try to answer it by an example. How do we arrive at truth? One thing I learned from going to Big Sandy to teach comparative religion, I thought I was going to just exhaustively look into the origin of certain words in the scriptures, and I was going to nail down, without any possible lack of definiteness, certain truths. I was going to nail down the word soul. I was going to nail down certain other words that were going to have to mean one thing and clearly always, every time, one thing. Well, to my surprise, in a lot of areas, God has written the Bible where it can be interpreted, where it can be altered, or where you can use human reasoning, and you can try to make it say several different things. So how do you know what's the truth? How do you arrive at the truth of the subject? Now, back in the second chapter of the book of Acts, Mr. Armstrong's been emphasizing lately a responsibility God has that he holds him accountable for. And he vigorously has taken this responsibility back to himself in the last couple of years. I realized more and more what was happening with the church until God raised him back up and put him back responsible more actively. But in Acts, the second chapter, a statement is made, they gladly received his word, verse 41, and were baptized. The same day, there were added about 3,000 souls. So now with these 3,000 added to the 120 they had earlier, they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and in breaking of bread and in prayers. So it's very plainly stated that these new converts, 3,000 of them, along with the previous 120, continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, as well as their fellowship, whether Bible study or Sabbath or during the week or whatever, in their meals and in prayers. Now, in the 16th chapter of Matthew, we run across a passage that, I guess in many ways, if you're of a typical Protestant background, these verses might frighten you. They might cause you a little bit of concern. Because here is where Christ says to Peter, verse 18, I also say to you, you're Peter, and on the rock Petra I'll build my church, and the gates of the grave won't prevail against it. And I'm going to give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Now Christ, in contrast, said to the Jews that they shut up the kingdom of heaven to men. They locked people out of the kingdom of heaven. Whereas to Peter he said, I give you the keys, and he'd open the door, open the way into the kingdom. So just the opposite, Christ said to his disciples from what he said to the Pharisees. I give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And I think most of us, when we look back and come to understand how we arrived at the truth we believe, God actually unlocked the doors, opened the truth to us by a man that he raised up, and just as he did with Peter here, gave the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Now, when you look up the word keys, you find several examples in Scripture. The key of David is one in Revelation 3. The keys are means of opening things to people. And God has given that responsibility to the apostles, or the apostles, depending on the age. I give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. As an example of this, I want to turn to one particular scripture, and then I want to read part from a couple of papers that have been turned in over the last 7 years, either into the doctrinal committee or into the ministry or into the leaders. And I think because of what's taken place in the area, maybe the acquaintance with these papers has gotten around among the people here in Southern California. And instead of sticking with the truth that they had unlocked to them by God's apostle, they've wandered off by other people's teaching. In Matthew chapter 22, Matthew 22, beginning verse 15, the Pharisees went and took counsel how they might entangle Christ in his talk. They sent out to him their disciples with the Herodians. They said, "Teacher, we know you're true. You teach the way of God in truth. Neither do you care for anyone. You're not a respecter of persons, in other words. You don't regard the person of men. So you tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not?" Now, right away when you read that, one word strikes you in a hurry. This is the King James Protestant translation from back in 1611. And notice what they say. Is it lawful to give tribute? I've never given tribute. I've always paid taxes. I've always paid tribute. You know, you try to get away without giving it. It's not voluntary. It's not give. It's pay. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Of course, they had different opinions among themselves in the time. Jesus perceived their wickedness, and right away he labeled them for what they are. "Why do you tempt me, hypocrite? You're not sincere in this. You're not really wanting to know the truth. You're not really interested in knowing the way it is. You show me the tribute money." Well, they brought him a penny. And he said to them, "Whose is this image and this inscription?" Well, he said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Give to Caesar whatever you want to give to Caesar, and give to God whatever you want to give to God." Well, that's not the teaching of the scripture here. That's not what Christ said. You know, being from the South, when I read the word render, the only time I've ever been acquainted with that word is when you take a pig and you make soap out of the pig fat. You know, you render lard and you make soap out of this pig fat. That's a weird word, render. How do you render, therefore, unto Caesar the things of Caesar, and to God the things that are God's? Now, if you read this in several other translations, it's kind of interesting what they say. The Amplified Bible says, "Pay, therefore, to Caesar the things that are due to Caesar, and pay to God the things that are due to God." Now, is the Amplified right there? They know what they're talking about? Or is the King James Protestant translation better? Give to Caesar tribute. Well, the Living Bible says, "Give it to Caesar if it's his. Give God everything that belongs to God." How do you do that? What belongs to God? How do you give to God everything that belongs to God? Well, you've got to find out what all belongs to God. And then whatever all belongs to God, then you've got to give everything that belongs to God to God. So even the Living Bible, which is in many cases a thick paraphrase instead of a Living Bible, but in a lot of cases, it helps out on some areas. The Williams translation says, "Pay Caesar, therefore, what belongs to Caesar, and pay God what belongs to God." So there's a lot of difference in translating. Do you give or do you pay? Is it what's due to God? Is it everything that belongs to God? You know, people would have you believe that in the New Testament, there's a different law, and the law in the New Testament is free will offering. But back in the Old Testament, that was the dispensation of law. And back there you had this law of tithing. But in the New Testament, we're free from that. We're liberated. We have free will offering. Now that's a farce. That's not biblical, and that's not the truth. Free will offering originated in the Old Testament. Didn't originate in the New Testament. Along with the tithing law existed the free will offering. You don't have the contrast between what was the law of the Old Testament compared to the liberty of the New Testament. First place, we ought to get over being duped by that Old Testament-New Testament argument. Can you show me any Bible basis for calling that Old Testament and New Testament? Where'd that idea come from, anyway? Isn't that really one whole book altogether? Isn't that really the way you're to understand the Holy Scriptures? You know, the old part isn't complete without the new, and the new part isn't complete without the old. It's interesting to me, though, how many things people want to pass off as Old Testament and then say, we just live by the New Testament. Let me read a statement. Even the Companion Bible, Appendix 95, page 137, with reference to this idea about Old and New Testament. The word Testament, as a translation of the Greek word diatheke, D-I-A-T-H-E-K-E, which means covenant. You know, how many times in the Bible, if you looked up with a concordance, Old Testament, would you ever find that? One place. One place. And it shouldn't even be there, that one place. Not an Old Testament. It's the Old Covenant. Well, what was the difference between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant? Well, the difference between the letter and the spirit. But notice what he goes on to say. The word testament, as a translation of that Greek word, has been nothing less than a great calamity. And boy, as an ex-Baptist, all I can say is amen, brother. You sure know what you're talking about. Nothing less than a great calamity. Because by its use, truth has been effectually veiled all through the centuries. How many churches do you know of that get around the Holy Scriptures by saying, well, that's Old Testament. And, you know, we don't follow that in the New Testament. You ought to quit calling it that. God never did call it that. Christ never in his whole life called it the Old Testament. Peter never did call it the Old Testament. James never did call it the Old Testament. John never did call it the Old Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't call it the Old Testament. You know, all the way through the New Testament, as we call it, they referred to the Scriptures, the Holy Scriptures, the Scriptures of truth. They talked about the law and the prophets and the writings. They talked about Torah, the law. They never did call it the Old Testament. And Paul, only by a poor translation, is blamed for calling it that in Corinthians. But as he says, to use this word, Testament, the way it's been used is nothing less than a great calamity. By such, truth has been effectually veiled all through the centuries, causing a wrong turning to be taken as to the purposes and character of this present dispensation, by which the errors of tradition have usurped the place of important truth. The word Testament, as a name for a collection of books, is unknown to Scripture. It comes to us through the Latin Vulgate. And yet, how many things do we eliminate, do away with, circumvent, cancel, get around by branding it Old Testament? Now, back in Matthew 22, in checking a little more thoroughly into what this statement really says, you know, some people say, well, there's just no command to tithe in the New Testament. In the first place, is that a policy to go by? Everything has to be commanded in the New Testament? Otherwise, you're not going to abide by it? What's that doing to the Holy Scriptures? What kind of an attitude is that toward God's sacred Word? In the first place, checking out the word render, you find out the Greek word is APODIDOMI. What does that word mean? Well, I've checked that up in the Thayer's Lexicon and Englishman's Greek Concordance and various other translations, and there are several other places the same word is used. And it's kind of interesting to see the other places the same word is used. For example, the fourth chapter of Luke. Luke 4 and verse 20. Luke 4 verse 20. He closed the book and gave it again to the minister. Returned it to the minister. Gave back to the minister. Gave it again. And that's the same Greek verb as the one translated back here, render, in Matthew 22. He gave it back to. So if you render to God the things that are God's, you're just giving back to God what already belonged to God, what never did belong to you, what was always owned by God, and you're paying it back. Now, there are other interesting translations. Luke 9, verse 42. As he was yet a-coming, the devil threw him down, tear him, and Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the child and delivered him again to his father. Same Greek verb, delivered him again. Give back to, return to, restore to, turn over to the owner what's owed, what he owns. Again in Luke chapter 10, verse 35, on the morrow when he departed, he took out 2 pence, gave them to the host, and said to them, take care of him, and whatsoever you spend more when I come, I will repay. Same Greek verb, repay. Repay to God. The things that belong to God, the things that are due God, the things you owe God, I will repay. Now you might notice in Luke 19, verse 8, Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. Now here they translate it, give. I turn over to the poor. I give them their due. God holds me accountable as owing the poor. So I pay the poor what God tells me I owe them. If I've taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore. Give it back. It was his. I took it from him falsely. I give it back to him fourfold. You know, the word is used many other times in the New Testament. In the Thayer's Lexicon, as a definition, they say to pay off, to discharge what is due. Because a debt, like a burden, is thrown off by being paid. A debt. The German word, abtragen, would be the same word. Then they give a number of examples of where the word is used. It's translated tribute, and others due the government. It's translated produce, due. Things promised under oath, translated this way. To give back, to restore, to requite, to recompense. Pay back, to recompense. And they give many other places where the same term is used. You might notice in Matthew chapter 6, that your alms may be in secret, and your Father that sees in secret himself shall recompense you. He'll pay you back. He'll reward you for what you've given. In verse 6, when you pray, enter into your closet. When you shut your door, pray to the Father that's in secret. Your Father that sees in secret shall recompense you. He'll pay you back for it. He'll reward you for it. Same thing in verse 18. But there are many other places the same verb is translated. So what he really says back here in Matthew is, pay back to God what belongs to God. And pay back to Caesar what belongs to his. It's got his picture on it. He's entitled to it. It's his nation that produces it. Now, looking back, come back to Numbers. I want to look at a few of these other scriptures back in the Old Testament on Numbers 18, and beginning verse 20, reviewing some of these Old Testament laws that we've come to understand and any newer people need to be grounded in. But the Eternal spake to Aaron, "You shall have no inheritance in their land, neither shall you have any part among them." In other words, like priests or ministers, to not get caught up in their property or their physical provisions, but to keep available for serving all times. "You'll have no inheritance, neither shall you have any part among them. I'm your part and your inheritance among the children of Israel. And behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tents in Israel for an inheritance." Now, there are several Bible encyclopedias that point out how this excludes any other use for any of this tenth at all, except as consecrated for this purpose God set aside. "I have given the children of Levi all the tents in Israel for an inheritance, for their service which they serve, the service of the tabernacle, the congregation." Then he repeats this in verse 24. "The tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer, and heave offering unto the Eternal, I have given to the Levites to inherit." Now, did then these tithes all of a sudden belong to Levites? And therefore, when there was no Levite, then you couldn't pay this tithe to anybody because it says, "I've given all the tenth to the Levites." And yet, you know, back in Malachi, we might turn back and read there. Notice in Malachi, verse 8 of chapter 3, Malachi 3 and verse 8. "Will a man rob God?" So you notice when you don't pay your tithe, you're not robbing the Levite. If it belonged to him, even though God gave it to him for his service that he rendered to God, God still considered it his, even though he gave it to them for their upkeep and their livelihood. And yet, when a man doesn't pay that tithe to the Levite, he's not robbing the Levite, he's robbing God. But if you were to interpret the law as saying, well, God gave all the tithes to the Levite, therefore when there wasn't any more Levite, then there's no more obligation to tithe. You know, some people in their reasoning would say, since there aren't any Levitical priests today and any priests of Aaron, therefore there can't be any tithe law. But that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says when you don't tithe, you're not robbing the Levite, you're not robbing the priest of Aaron, you're robbing God. "Yet you've robbed me," God says. "Well, you say, wherein have we robbed you?" And you know, in a sense, the prophet Malachi, writing right before the years between the Old and the New Testament periods, the years between those times, God anticipated what the people were going to end up doing, and as a warning, through his last prophet, he warned about people forsaking tithing. And yet in many cases, the book of Malachi is as if he's a prophet warning those of us down in the end time. Also, many of the things in Malachi apply directly in this end time setting today. The coming of Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Remembering the law of Moses that God would raise back up. Restoration of the knowledge and the obedience to the law of Moses, along with the statutes and judgments. Doesn't it seem rather striking that the very last prophet, before the time period leading up to what we call the New Testament time, the very last prophet would warn about forsaking the law of Moses, about robbing God, about forsaking the tithe? Notice verse 4 of chapter 4. The very last paragraph, God inspired the very last prophet to warn, "Remember the law of Moses, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel." And then notice what he says specifically to remember. The statutes and judgments, not just the Ten Commandments. Don't just remember the Ten Commandments. Remember the law of Moses, the statutes and judgments. And then right in contact with the warning, he says, I'll send you Elijah before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. So a very obvious end-time warning and setting, and yet one of the things connected with sending the Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord is remembering the law of Moses, the statutes and judgments. And, you know, sure enough, that's what God has caused Mr. Armstrong and the church today to do, because the Church of God Seventh Day very much believes in the Ten Commandments, but they certainly don't believe, as this church does, keeping the statutes and judgments. I mentioned to the people up in Portland, I used to have an extra sermon I carried around in the back of my Bible all the time when I was up in Portland, and then anybody from the Church of God Seventh Day would come in, I'd take that sermon out and I'd give that one all over again. It was about the differences in the laws. You know, what laws were meant to be kept forever and which ones weren't. Which ones were ceremonies and rituals and which ones weren't. And, you know, by continually reminding them about God's laws, ended up about half of that Church of God Seventh Day forsook their place and started coming over where we met. And all of a sudden, Mr. Duggar came roaring back from Israel to have a campaign to get all these people back that they'd lost up there. But you know, one of the keys is understanding the differences in the laws. Why would God's last prophet, in his last paragraph, tell you to remember the statutes and judgments, and then Christ comes right away and buries them all, nails them all to the stake, cancels them, eliminates them? That's kind of ridiculous. You know, what kind of a book is the Bible to advocate that kind of an idea? And yet, as a part of that, in remembering the law of Moses, the statutes and judgments, it's connected in with tithing in verse 8. Will a man rob God? And then the people who are doing it, like Laodiceans, you ever notice the word you say in the book of Malachi? That's a Laodicean attitude. If you tie that in with Revelation 3, you remember the Laodiceans say, you say. God tells them one thing and you say. God tells them another thing and you say. And it ties right in with this warning in Malachi. You say, well, wherein have we robbed you? Not a law, it's just a matter of giving. It's free will, you know. It's a matter of New Testament liberty. And then the prophet says, bring you all the tithes, the whole tithes, into the storehouse. He says, I'll rebuke the devourer for your sake. So even though God set aside that tithe, all of that tithe in Israel for the Levite, it still belonged to God. It was God. He was just letting them use it as ones who worked for Him. Now you might tie that in with Leviticus 27. Leviticus 27. You know, it's kind of interesting how people's minds, when they get intellectual or technical, and they can get down into the twigs and forget the trunk of the tree. And that's one of the great things God calls a man who sticks to the trunk of the tree. You know, Mr. Herbert Armstrong has always been on the trunk of the tree. I've heard him say to us many a time, okay, you venture some young men, venture on out on those limbs and get them broken off from under you. You know, for me, I'm staying on the trunk of the tree. So a lot of us have, you know, we've gone venturing out on all kinds of twigs and limbs, and fools rush in where angels fear to tread. But you know, Mr. Armstrong has always been a trunk of the tree man. Now notice here in Leviticus 27, verse 30, all the tithe of the land, and you know what a technical mind does all of a sudden? Well, only the tithe of the land of Israel is sacred to God. He's the God of Israel, therefore no other land. The tithe is unclean. So that's the way the mind gets around God's law. They say, why, you can't tithe off of Babylonian land. That's unclean. That's corrupt money. You can't. It isn't God's land. The Holy Land is God's land, and you can only tithe from the Holy Land. Now, is that a sensible argument? That's all it is, an argument, not the truth. You know, if that were the case, I can show you a scripture. Well, let's turn over there a second. In Psalm chapter 50, God says, verse 9, I'll take no bullock out of your house, two goats out of your flock, for every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon the Palestinian hills are mine.
You know what that says? That's not what my Bible says.
There aren't 1,000 hills in Judea. No, there aren't 1,000 hills in Palestine. Where do we get that kind of an argument? God says every beast of the forest. He doesn't say every beast of the Palestinian forest is mine. And the cattle upon the Palestinian hills, they're all mine. That isn't what he says. That's what he ought to say. If tithing is only from Israel, only from the Holy Land, only from Palestine, that isn't what he says. Every beast of the forest and the cattle on 1,000 hills. You know, every time I'm driving across the country, I look out and I see cattle all over the hills. I think of that scripture. All those cattle belong to God. No matter whether you're in India, whether you're in Africa, whether you're in Russia, it doesn't make any difference where you are. All of the cattle on 1,000 hills belong to God. But you're a technical, cleaning out the gnat, swallowing the camel kind of a mind. Reads back here in Leviticus 27, and it says, all the tithe of the land, that means just the land of Israel, whether the seed of the land or the fruit of the tree, is the eternal. And then right away, you notice, they'll say, well, you know, it doesn't say anything about the fish in the lake, so you don't tithe if you're a fisherman, and it doesn't say anything about pottery makers, and doesn't say anything about hunters, and the only guy that gets flat with the tithing law is the farmer. So he's always had it, you know, even back in the Bible. He's the poor guy that always got it. What kind of a radical, cleaning out a gnat, swallowing a camel kind of a mind is that? All the tithe of the land, or the seed of the land, or the fruit of the tree, is the eternal. It is holy unto the eternal. Is that only because it's holy land? Therefore, any produce of it's holy, or is it holy because it all belongs to God? No matter where it is. Well, even here, the same term, all the tithe, like we read in Numbers, God gave to the Levite, yet here he says, all the tithe is holy unto the eternal. Doesn't say it's holy unto the Levite. Doesn't say it's holy unto the Aaronic priest. It's holy unto the eternal. And that's the way it is. That's true. Now you might notice back in Deuteronomy, chapter 12, I've rarely ever heard anybody explain the worldwide Church of God doctrine about tithing accurately when they're called on the radio or in the press. They always want to seem to leave it unexplained, and it makes it sound bad, you know. I say, well, you mean that Armstrong takes 30% from you people? Well, that isn't true. You know, I remember one ex-minister back in East Texas was interviewed on a Church of Christ radio program, and they asked him about this idea that Armstrong takes 30% from the people. And you know, he knows better than that. You think he clarified that on the air? You think he explained that the way it really is? You think he said, now, wait a minute now, let me get this straight. After you set aside God's tithe to show how kind and generous and good God is, he turns right around and tells you to spend an equal amount on yourself. That's some kind of a God, isn't it? After he gives you all of it and then requires you to pay him back the first tenth, then he turns right around and says, now that you've given me mine, I'm just going to turn right around and command you to save another 10% for yourself. Now he says, there are going to be people that aren't able to manage real well, and you're going to have the poor. So let's work out some kind of a plan on that. How much should a person give to the poor? Well, maybe about 3% a year, or 2.8% or something. But I'll have you do it twice in 7 years, and have you let the land rest on the seventh year so it'll produce more and better and return back to you more because you have faith in God's law and you obey it. But you know, people don't explain that. Now notice back in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 1, very plainly, as we read in Malachi, these are the statutes and... So tithing is one of the statutes. It shows your duty to God, like judgment or judge's decisions made between a man and his brother. The statute
You observe to be in the land, which the eternal God of your fathers gives you to possess it. So right away, a technical mind would say, see there, it didn't say any land or all lands. It just says, you shall observe to do in the land, which the eternal God of your fathers gives you to possess it. When God put the Israelites into the promised land, he left it up to them to take the land. Did he give it to them? He was going to give them far more land than they finally took. But does this mean that unless you're in Palestine, you don't have to tithe because you're not in the land that God gave them? You know, people use the same kind of reasoning about the holy days and say, well, you don't need to keep the holy days because the only place God set aside to keep the holy days is Jerusalem. You go to the place God chose, and that was Jerusalem. And it wasn't the first place he chose. You know, God had another place before that he chose, and he changed his mind, and later chose another place. And a little later after that, he changed his mind again and had another place. That doesn't make sense at all. If you have to be in Jerusalem, technically, by the letter of the law, if you're going to keep the feast. We have examples in the New Testament of them keeping the feast, and they weren't in Jerusalem. But anyway, you shall observe to do in the land the Lord your God of your fathers gives you to possess it all the days you live on the earth. Then he talks about getting rid of the heathen establishment that's been there before, and he said you can't follow their practices to worship your God. Don't see how other nations worship their gods and say you're going to worship me that way. I'm God, and I tell you how you can worship me. And if you don't worship me the way I tell you, then you worship me in vain. So does God have that prerogative as God to tell you how to worship him? Or does God just leave it up to you to decide you'll worship God as you please? Well, notice what he says, verse 5. Unto the place which the eternal your God shall choose out of all your tribes. So that leaves quite a wide choice there. God can choose out of any of the tribes. And later on, when the Gentiles started obeying God's ways, they even had places in Corinth and other areas. So God has chosen places according as he's chosen people to live his way. God just chooses and puts his name on a place, and then that's the habitation you seek, and that's where you go. And there you bring your tithes. Now, we already read in Numbers 18:21 that God gave all the tithes to the children of Levi. And now he says, here you bring your tithes and heave offerings, vows, freewill offerings, firstlings. Verse 7, there you who are doing the bringing to the place God chose, there you eat before the eternal your God. You rejoice, that all that you put your hand to, you and your household. Don't do like you've been doing, every man what's right in his own eyes. But he said, now there's going to be a place I'm going to choose, verse 11, to cause my name to dwell. There you bring all that I command you, your tithes, and you rejoice. Don't forget the Levite, he has no partner inheritance. Do all I command you, verse 14 he says. Now, verse 17 he says, you can't eat within your gates this tithe, but the one who's doing the bringing is the one who's doing the eating of it. And yet back in Numbers he said all the tenth, all the tithe he's given to the Levite. And now here he says, you're bringing tithes to the place God chooses. You can't eat it within your gate, and you eat it there before God with your household, and don't forget the Levite. What can that be other than a second tithe? You know, what can that be other than an additional tithe? That can't be the same tithe. That is impossible. The statement back in Numbers nails down that as belonging to the Levite. And yet here it talks about you bringing tithes and eating it. Now notice, again, people with these gnat-training minds and camel-swallowing minds, in verse 17 they say, you may not eat within your gate the tithe of your corn, wine, and oil. So I guess you don't even have any meat. You don't have anything but corn, wine, and oil. That's going to be a crummy feast, you know, for 8 days, corn, wine, and oil. Corn, wine, and oil, over and over and over. Well, that's no way to rejoice. Your household's going to say, yuck, you know, corn, wine, and oil. But you know, people with technical minds want to say, well, see, there it doesn't say a word about animals, doesn't say a word about fish and other things. It just says corn, wine, and oil. Now, might the term corn, wine, and oil be general summary terms for products of that particular type? And that's exactly what it is. You know, you ever take a concordance and look up corn, wine, and oil? Well, I did that. Look, notice Genesis 27. This is the story between Jacob and Esau. And verse 27, he came near, kissed him, smelled the smell of his raiment, blessed him. See, the smell of my sons, the smell of the field, the eternal's blessed. Therefore, God give you of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. So I guess that's all God blesses you. When you are going to live God's way, then he's going to give you plenty of dew and plenty of corn and wine. No wheat, no meat, no fish or chicken, just corn and wine. Over and over and over. Those are just terms of blessing. They're not to be trained out like gnats and falling camels. Notice verse 37. Isaac answered and said to Esau, behold, I've made him your lord, and all his brethren I've given to him for servant, and with corn and wine I've sustained him, and what'll I do now to you, my son? So a lot of us just need to go on a perpetual diet of corn and wine, I guess, and we'd be healthier and happier, and our whole households would really joy. That's ridiculous. Deuteronomy 7, verse 13. I could show you scriptures that talk about corn, wine, and oil all the rest of the afternoon. Deuteronomy 7, 13. It's going to come to pass, if you hearken to these judgments and you keep and do them, the eternal your God's going to keep you the covenant and the mercy that he swore to your fathers. He'll love you, bless you, multiply you, bless the fruit of your womb, the fruit of your land, your corn, your wine, and your oil. No grapes, though. No chickens and fish. The increase of your cattle and the flocks of your sheep in the land that he swore to your fathers to give you. You know, you can't train out gnats and swallow camels technically that way. Notice Deuteronomy 28, what we call a blessing and cursing chapter, and look what he says here. You shall eat the fruit of your cattle, this is when you're disobeying God, the fruit of your land, till you be destroyed, which shall not leave you corn, wine, or oil, or the increase of your kine or flock. Those are summary statements that cover the whole area of blessings and produce and animals, and not to be taken technically that you don't tithe or you're not blessed by anything outside of those few terms. And come back to Deuteronomy again. You know, I kind of feel like Mr. Armstrong does. I don't see why anybody wants to change the system. Seems to me this church's done pretty well for about 52 years. You know, I don't know why we need to be liberated from tithing, and, you know, why do we need to be saved by all these intellectuals that come along and they want to get this big burden of tithing off of us, and they promise us liberty, but you know what's going to happen? The people that promise you liberty, if that liberty is not having to tithe, it's not going to be liberty they bring down on you. It's going to be a curse. It's going to be a catastrophe. You know, in the years ahead, it's going to get tougher and tougher to tithe. What if we were in a country like some of them overseas where they don't allow you to deduct all of your donations to a church? What if all of a sudden the worldwide church got canceled out and their donations weren't tax deductible? Would you still tithe anyway? Well, you may be tested on that. God's going to find out if your heart's really in the work and if the work really is your life or not. And a lot of us have proven that it didn't, because where our treasure is hasn't been in tithing to God's work. Notice going on here in Deuteronomy 12, how else would you explain this? And you know, not only that, but not that you go by secular sources, but there are many sources that recognize and admit that in the Jewish tradition or the Old Testament practice, there were three separate tithes. I mean, Josephus very plainly states that. There are many other writers that very plainly state that. As a matter of fact, the only alternative are arguments about whether maybe the second tithe was used a different way on the third year. Now, you know, stop and think about that. Have you ever read anybody explain that? Have you ever read where anybody expounded on that and clarified that and showed you how that really worked? That's no new argument. That's been an argument probably since God instituted the tithing law. What do? Just don't have holy days on the third year? If you take the feast tithe and you use it for charity on the third year, then what about the holy days on the third year? Do you find any records in the Bible where they had holy days 2 years and skipped one, and 2 years and skipped one, and then skipped one, and then two more years and then skipped one? I never have read that. What I've read is where they had them year by year, year after year after year after year after year. I never read where they skipped years. It would be intellectuals would have you believe that that's something possible from Scripture. Well, notice here in Deuteronomy 12, God plainly says, you may not eat within your gate this tithe that he's talking about in chapter 12 of your corn, wine, and oil, or the firstlings of your herds or your flock, nor any of the vows that you vow, nor your free will offering. What on earth is that doing in the Old Testament? Free will offerings? I thought that was what we have in the New Testament instead of that old law of tithing. Why, you had free will offerings back there long before the New Testament ever heard of it. But that's some tricky argument people use. God says, verse 18, you must eat it before the eternal your God, in the place the eternal your God chooses. You and your son and your daughter and your manservant and your maidservant. Interestingly enough, God doesn't allow you to cram it down your wife's throat, you notice. God says your son and your daughter and your manservant and your maidservant. But the law for adults is you got to obey God as you are called and shown the truth. Now, he goes on in the same place, verse 21, if the place God's chosen to put his name is too far from you, then you kill your herd and your flock as God commanded you, and you eat in your gate. Anything, whether anything that's clean, like the roebuck and hart, they're both clean and you eat them. Don't let the blood be there. You've got to pour it out. He said, don't follow the nations and see how they serve their God. Now in chapter 14, continuing with the story, you know the way some people would have you believe, you've got the one law of Exodus and Leviticus, and then a little later God had a second thought and he kind of changed some and added some more in Deuteronomy, and the second giving of the law contradicted the first giving of the law, and that isn't true. God adds to his law and magnifies the law and clarifies the law. Now when you get into Deuteronomy 14, he's giving them various laws. Don't eat of anything that dies of itself, verse 21. Verse 22, you shall truly tithe, in other words, honestly, accurately, faithfully, honestly and accurately and faithfully tithe all the increase of your seed that the eternal, that the field brings forth year by year. All right, now what tithe is he talking about here? Honestly, accurately, faithfully tithing all the increase. Well, the only way you can tell which tithe he's talking about is what's done with it. And God makes that obvious. Truly tithe year by year, and you shall eat. So now you know it's the one that God has given to you, what we call the second tithe, the feast tithe. You eat before the eternal your God, the place he chooses to place his name there, the tithe of your corn, wine, and oil, and the firstlings of your herd and the flock. And notice the reason. That you may learn to fear the eternal your God always. So somebody tells you you don't have to keep the feast on the third year and the sixth year because you use your second tithe for third tithe on those 2 years, and you'd better learn to fear the eternal your God. And when you go before God on holy days and you hear the sermons and you are with God's people and you're eating the tithe, then you're going to learn to fear the eternal your God always. You go when the holy days come, whether it's convenient or not. You take your kids out of school and they go and it may be difficult for them. But through all of that, you learn to fear the eternal your God always. Now, if the way is too long that you're not able to carry it, the place is too far, the Eternal chooses when the Eternal has blessed you. Now, notice that condition allows for some people that might not have enough income to be able to go every year. So the law says, when the Eternal, your God, has blessed you. So some people may have to save 2 years or 3 years. But they save faithfully, as verse 22 says. They honestly, accurately, faithfully tithe all their increase year by year. And when God has blessed them, then they go and eat before the Eternal all these things. If the way is too long, they just convert that over into money, turn it into money, verse 25, bind up that money in your hand, and you go to the place God has chosen, and you bestow that money for whatever your soul lusts after. Now notice then what this eating before God, this tithe God has given to you, can be done with. You can buy oxen, sheep, wine, strong drink, whatever your soul desires, just as long as you're before God in the place He chooses, you eat there before God, and you rejoice, and your household, and don't forget the Levite that's within your gate. He has no partner inheritance, so you're eating this tithe before God. Now, at the end of 3 years, you bring forth all the tithe of your increase, the same year, and you lay it up within your gate. Now all of a sudden it becomes obvious, one of them you've got to take before God in the place He shows and eat it yourself. But now all of a sudden, He's talking about at the end of 3 years, bringing forth all and keeping it within your gate. Well, is that you cancel out the holy days on the third year and sixth year? Is this another tithe? Well, just as many people believe it's another tithe, how can you know when you've got all these different sources? Well, God inspired Mr. Armstrong to understand that, sure enough, this is the charity tithe. It's the tithe for the poor, and it's only done during the third year. And then when you tie it into the seven-year cycle, it's done on the sixth year, and then you skip the seventh year, and it's done back again on the next third year. But at the end of the 3 years, the tithe that's different, He's already told you plainly about two, so He expects you to understand and realize that He's already told you about the other. So now He's telling you more, so you know that it's another one. At the end of 3 years, you bring forth all the tithe of your increase the same year, and you lay it up within your gate. Now the Levite, and the stranger, and the fatherless, and the widow within your gate come, and they eat, and they're satisfied. So you notice very plainly who uses this tithe and where they use it. They use it within your gate, each city or territory or property to itself. The stranger, fatherless, widow, within your gate, come and eat and are satisfied. Now notice the reason, that the Eternal your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. So it's going to be another test, this time instead of learning to fear God, because you care about strangers, fatherless, and widows, God is going to bless you in all the work of your hands. You'll have more increase. You'll be blessed even more so. When you read scriptures like this, what about if people don't obey that law and they begin to reason around that law? Come back to Malachi chapter 3 again. And here again is a mistranslation in the King James translation, Malachi chapter 3. Verse 5, God says, I'm going to come near to you to judgment. I'm going to be a swift witness against. All right, now who in Israel is God going to come near to judgment and be a swift witness against? Sorcerers, adulterers, false swearers, and against those that oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow and the fatherless, that turn aside the stranger from his right. What is the right of the fatherless, the widow, and stranger? How would you oppress the fatherless, the widow, and the stranger, and fear not God, If you're going to learn to fear God in paying your tithes and obeying God's tithing laws, you'll learn to fear God. But what if you lose the fear of God? You don't have any fear of God. And you begin to oppress. You ever check up the word oppress? You know what it really means? Defraud of their legal right. What is their legal right? When would you defraud a widow or a fatherless or a stranger? When you don't give them what God requires, when you're not obeying God's law, when you're disobeying God's law, of how do you take care of the fatherless, widow, and stranger?
And that's really what it's saying here. God is going to be a swift witness against us if we forsake the fatherless and the widow and the stranger. And you know, God's church has been blessed greatly as we get back on the track and we get the truths restored again. But you know, we haven't always had the truths restored. I got all of our four booklets we've had on tithing, you know. We've got one book used to be just kind of blunt, you know. It just said, tithing. Boy, that's blunt, you know. You don't like that, so you say, your best investment. That's a lot softer, isn't it? That's even softer, managing your personal finances. They're all good books. I've read all of them. Ending your financial worries. That's the best one because Mr. Armstrong wrote it. You ever compare those? I've just done that. I've been reading this one, reading that one, reading this one, reading this one. You know, it's kind of interesting to me. This got by Herbert W. Armstrong in there. I opened one of these and it says, Staff. And I've been hunting for him because I'd like to talk to old Bill Staff about some of the things he watered down in that booklet. It's kind of funny, though, you know. You can hide behind the company, hide behind Staff. Well, Mr. Herbert Armstrong doesn't mind putting his name on what he's got to say. He'd stick his neck right out there and say, now this is what I say. This is the way I believe it. Well, what would have happened if some of the liberals in the past had had their way, as stated very plainly in this booklet on tithing? I almost fell out of my chair down in Big Sandy one time because I was sitting there at the faculty dining room and this one church member who is a faculty member said, say, I'd like to hear you give a sermon on tithing. And I said, well, you know, we had one not too long ago. And he said, well, that was a basic sermon for new people. That wasn't really detailed about everything. And I said, well, why do you request that? And he said, well, I was out to an area and talked to an elder, and he said you tithe on the increase, so the only increase he had was the interest on his savings account. And I said, boy, an elder said that? He said, well, then I was talking to a faculty member, and he said that the new tithing booklet said you tithe on the net, not on the gross. I said, well, the new tithing booklet said that? I must not have read that one. I'll run over to the booklet booth and get me one of those. So I went over and I got it, and I read all the way through it, and still didn't say it. Did to him. But here he was, a faculty member, and he thought the section in that booklet that says, if you're poor in one of the countries, you know, where they have this high tax structure, then you can tithe on the net instead of the gross. Poor? Faculty salary? A poor guy? I knew what kind of a house he lived in. Poor? I'd have never considered him poor. But here he was excusing himself, tithing on the net, because he classified himself as poor. And I'm sure God's let him be what he's classified himself as. You know, I wouldn't need to tell you that guy isn't still in the church, would I? No, that guy's not still in the church. And a lot of people that are fudging on God and robbing from God, twisting the Bible, twisting and turning the Bible. What would happen to the widows in God's church if we'd listen to some of these liberals? What would happen to holy days? What would happen if all of a sudden we didn't go to the holy days every year? You know, we like to kid ourselves that we'd be giving just as much if it were just a free will offering. Now, I don't kid myself. I don't trust my human nature that much. And besides that, I've got a Christianity Today publication, and they show what these born-again, spirit-filled Christians give. You ever look at something like that? We're different, though, aren't we? If you didn't have to tithe by law, you'd just give more than you ever have given, wouldn't you? You got to be kidding. You wouldn't do any such thing. You know, when we said, well, you know, maybe people don't have to save the whole second tithe, and you know what happened? A lot of people didn't get to go to the feast next year. Are you gambling with your salvation when you hit and miss going to the feast? How many feasts do you think you could miss and still be headed right into God's kingdom? Well, they took a chart here and they showed that the average per capita income of an American in 1971 was $4,164. So the tithe of that annual per capita income would be $416. Well, you know how much people gave? The American Baptist, $80. United Methodist, $65. United Presbyterians, man, way up there, $115. Episcopalians, $110. Southern Baptists, $80. Seventh-day Adventists, $385. Almost the per capita tithe. Lutheran, United Church of Christ, you know, we didn't even get on the chart. I'd like to have seen us on the chart compared to these others. You know, we can't kid ourselves that in the New Testament we just be giving more and we'd be looking after widows. No, we wouldn't either, unless God's law requires it. Malachi chapter 3 says God is going to be a swift witness against any of us who defraud the widow and the fatherless and turn aside the stranger from his right. And the only way you do that is if you don't fear God. And if you fear God, you're not about to let yourself defraud the widows, and the fatherless, and the strangers from their right. He says, I'm the eternal, I don't change. That's a weird statement in the last book in the Old Testament when all that was changed going into the new one, isn't it? Can you imagine that? God's prophet saying, I'm the eternal, I don't change, and then he changed everything. The very next book. I don't change. Therefore, you sons of Jacob aren't consumed. Now notice verse 7. From the days of your fathers, you're gone away from my statutes. That's tithing. Holy days. What are the statutes? From the days of their fathers. That's what they've gone away from. God's statutes. They haven't kept them. God says, return to me. Go back to my statutes. Get back to my tithing laws. Get back to my laws against those sins mentioned in verse 5. Repent. Return to me. I'll return to you. But you lay the sins, you say. Well, where we got to return, God? Well, will a man rob God? That's the context of that statement. Notice Jeremiah chapter 7. Verse 5, if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, that's what judgments are, decisions governing conduct between a brother and a brother. If you thoroughly amend your ways and doings and thoroughly execute judgment, all right, what are you doing when you thoroughly execute judgment and amend your ways? Quit oppressing the stranger, fatherless, and widow. Why would God list that right off the bat first? A warning from Jeremiah. We've got to thoroughly amend our ways and doings and thoroughly execute judgment, not defraud from their legal right, not defraud from God's law that he gives for the stranger, fatherless, and widow. If you do, you're going to shed innocent blood in the place. Then I'll cause you to dwell in this place forever and ever. Notice Isaiah, the first chapter. When you spread forth your hands, verse 15, I'm going to hide mine eyes. You're going to make many prayers, and I'm not going to hear because your hands are full of blood. In what way? In what area are some people's hands full of blood? You know, I've known of people last year that were hunting for ways to spend their feast tithe. They just couldn't find enough ways to get rid of it. And yet we had widows that didn't get to go. That doesn't make sense. You know, that didn't used to be that way. Some of you old-timers that have been around for 20-some years, you remember it used to be everybody got to go every year. Everybody every year got to go because everybody had the love for one another and they didn't want to live high and eat the biggest and stay in the fanciest and just think about old number one. You know, when I first came to Ambassador College, I'd never heard of the Feast of Tabernacles. And I was up there in my Mayfair on the third floor, down here on the south end one time, and the guy said, "Well, are you getting ready to go?" I said, "Getting ready to go? What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, we're going to Siegler Springs." "So what in the world for?" "So, well, we're going up for the Feast of Tabernacles." I said, "The what?" I said, "The Feast of Tabernacles." "Well, I never heard any such thing. Besides that, I just got here. What are you leaving so soon after school started for? You know, that's poor planning. Looks like you could wait a little later on when it'd be more convenient." They said, "Well, we don't get to set when." I said, "Well, who does?" "Well, it's right there in the Bible." I said, "Oh, yeah, where?" So they began to show me what I've been going through today. I said, "Well, boy, that's in there, all right. Now, what good does that do me now? Y'all are all getting ready to leave, and I just got out here, and you know what's going to happen?" They said, "Oh, well, we'll all pitch in and give you some of ours." I said, "What? You're going to pay me to take a vacation at Siegler Springs for 8 days?" Now, you try that out in the Methodist church, the Baptist church. Tell them you want them to all pitch in and give you an 8-day vacation at Siegler Springs or Squaw Valley or Jekyll Island or somewhere. Now, don't go there this year, but, you know. What? I'd never heard of the feast, but all of a sudden they said, "Well, we'll pitch in and help you." I never heard any such thing. Dr. Hay invited me to go stay at his house before the feast, and I couldn't believe that. People give money they've saved all year to other people so they can stay in a nice motel and have good meals. Man, that sounds like Philadelphians. That sounds like people that love their brothers. But down through time, something's happened, you know, and I've seen people go to two or three feast sites, just lay members, decide they're going to go to two or three feast sites just because they got that much money. And widows don't get to go, sometimes every 2 years, sometimes every 3 years. Well, boy, when I read Isaiah 1, I wouldn't want to be in that boat. God says, "When you spread forth your hands, I'm going to hide mine eyes from you. When you make many prayers, I'm not going to hear because your hands are full of blood." Where, God? Who, me? You know, wash you. Make you clean. Put away the evil of your doing. Learn to do well. All right? Now, get down to specifics, God. Where do we need to wash and make our hands clean? And where, God, do we need to learn to do well and seek judgment? Number one, look. Quit frauding the widow and the fatherless and the oppressed. Quit depriving them of their legal right. You know, in the New Testament, Jesus said, "You devour widows' houses." You ever scratch your head and wonder what that is all about? Same thing. Not paying the tithe that takes care of the fatherless and the widow and the stranger. You don't think that's in the New Testament too? Why, there it's all one book. It's all united. It's the Holy Scriptures. Not any New Testament. Doesn't say anything different in the whole Bible. You rob widows' houses? You defraud the widows? Boy, I'll tell you, there are hundreds of warnings about that. Notice Ezekiel 18, verse 12. Here God is talking about righteousness and has oppressed the poor and needy. Here he's talking about a man begetting a son that goes away from God, and one of the evils he does is oppress the poor and the needy. There again, oppress them. Verse 16, neither have oppressed any, nor withheld your pledge. Notice Ezekiel 22. In you they have set light by father and mother. In the midst of you they've dealt by oppression with the stranger. They've vexed the fatherless and the widow. How do you deal with oppression? Deceit's what he's talking about. Fraud, depriving of their legal rights, what he's talking about. In Israel, they've dealt that way with the stranger, fatherless and the widow, and vex them in that way. Verse 29, he says, the people of the land have used oppression and exercised robbery by vexing the poor and the needy, by their oppressing of the stranger wrongfully from his right. Boy, those are sure better if you translate them accurately. But there's warning in all books of prophecy about that very thing. In Matthew 23:14, he talks about robbing widows' houses. How do you do that, rob a widow's house? Is he literally talking about breaking in with a mask and holding up, or is he talking about defrauding widows, what's their right, what the law is entitling them to? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you've become hypocrites because you devour widows' houses. You don't have pure religion and undefiled, taking care of the fatherless and the widows. You ever notice that when they find those terms lumped together, it's really talking about God's tithe that He set aside for the fatherless and the widow and the stranger and the poor and the Levite? You ought to mark those when you run across those where they're all listed together, because that's what they're talking about. I'd like to read a few comments from a couple of papers that have been turned in the past. The main purpose of this paper is to assemble material from the Bible and from the long history of extra-biblical literature on tithing and how the tithing instructions were interpreted and applied after the end of the Old Testament. Is that what we want to go by, you know? Why the end of the Old Testament? I didn't know it ended. I thought it was still in effect and still in force. And where do you go to find interpretations and how they applied the laws of God? Well, I believe what Mr. Armstrong's been inspired to teach. I believe what he's been able to show us in the Scriptures. And research doesn't disprove that. Research just shows that some people take it the way that it is true, and others interpret it another way that's not the truth. Extra-biblical evidence and practice is important. It can help to show how the laws were interpreted by those entrusted with the care of the Hebrew Scriptures. Well, in a lot of ways, I don't care how those who were entrusted with the care of the Hebrew Scriptures interpreted them. Because if I want to know the truth about the Holy Days, I don't go to the Jews. If they did, I'd have two trumpets, and I'd think the trumpets is a new year, and I wouldn't even know it's Christ's second coming. And you know, there are a lot of areas you can't go to those who are entrusted with the care of the Scriptures, whether they were Greeks or Hebrews. The Jews may have preserved the correct tradition. Purely voluntary poor fund would replace the present third tithe. Boy, watch out with it. You're going to be hungry. Trusting human nature for that. A pure voluntary poor fund. Well, into that we could also put a part of the excess second tithe given by the individual member of his own choice. You notice this emphasis on individual liberty and individual freedom and no law and... Or it might be diverted there officially by the administrator. More consideration could be given to a person's financial position. Those on fixed incomes, like widows, may not be in a position to tithe. I never heard of anybody who wasn't in a position to tithe. And it's kind of like Cyrus Brown that was hanging upside down in the well. That's a great position to pray in. Well, I never heard of anybody in a position not to tithe. You're going to be in a worse position if you don't. Many such people could get by without needing third tithe assistance if they don't tithe. Well, that's good reasoning, except it isn't going to work. These suggested changes wouldn't keep a person from giving as much as ever to the work. It would allow more personal initiatives and freedom. That's the person who now automatically pays a certain percentage because he's told to. Would have to assert a little more willpower and make a little bigger decision. Those who are really feeling the pinch, many of them leading rather miserable lives. I never have met any of those. I've only been a minister 28 years. I guess I just haven't seen it. People leading miserable lives because of tithing? I don't believe that. And here, you know, who sets the church doctrine? I'm sure glad they didn't have the power to do it. I'm glad they didn't get away with it. Implications of this study for church doctrine. For second and third tithe, Jews had two separate traditions. Whether only theoretical or actually practiced is impossible to say. But the stronger tradition is that the second tithe was paid to the poor in the third and sixth years by religious Jews and wasn't taken up to Jerusalem. So we want to follow the Jews in their separate tradition. But one of their traditions was that they did pay the third tithe on the third year and the sixth year. I've never read anybody explain what happens, the whole plan of God, when you turn your second tithe to the poor on the third and sixth years. The second and third tithe evidently didn't apply to animals, since firstlings were the only animals mentioned in connection. It also seems the second and third tithe was figured only on the remainder. I never read any evidence or proof of that anywhere. Tithing is given little place in the New Testament. Unclean meats aren't given any place in the New Testament. So let's all go out and have a ham sandwich, huh? Where would you find in the New Testament everything listed that's clean and unclean? You don't. How many parts that you can't get without the Old Testament? Tithing is given little place in the New Testament. Certainly no system of first, second, and third is delineated, either by express command or by example. The only real instruction one could draw from the New Testament alone, I didn't know we needed to draw instruction from the New Testament alone. The only real instruction you could do that is that the ministry and those spreading the gospel should be supported by the faithful. Nowhere is tithing as opposed to free will offering. I didn't know they were opposed. I thought you did them both, in the old and the new. They're not one instead of the other. One replaced the other in a different dispensation, one instead of the other. That isn't it. That isn't true. These five summarizing points lead naturally to several questions and implications. Our present church policy, well, you know, Mr. Herbert Armstrong's the one that sets the church policy. And thank God, God's kept him alive to keep it. Because it seemed like the church done pretty well in the last 52 years, you know. We've taken care of the widows, and, you know, God says of the Philadelphian church, we haven't denied his word, we've kept his word, and we haven't denied his name, and we've kept the faith, and, well, those are the kind of papers. The other paper is even a lot longer. Let's just turn to the few examples in the New Testament. We'll, Matthew 23, you know, if a person takes the Bible as a whole, and you go through and you notice what each king did when he restored God's worship, whether it be Hezekiah or whether it be any of the others back in Kings and Chronicles, you'll find out they always restored the statutes and judgments. They restored the tithing. You read back in 2 Chronicles 29 or 2 Chronicles 31 how Hezekiah restored the tithing. That was always done. Nehemiah, when he came back from the captivity and restored the worship, restored tithing, and the holy days. In Nehemiah chapter 10, of course, again, all the way through those books. But here, Christ very plainly, adding to what we have learned, God adds to the knowledge that we've got in the Old Testament, and he says, verse 23, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, because you're hypocritical, because you'll be so precise when it comes to tithing of every little thing like mint and anise and cumin." Now that doesn't sound like they just tithed on corn, wine, and oil, does it? And it doesn't sound like they just tithed on it when they were in Palestine or something. He says, you pay tithe of mint, anise, and cumin, and you've omitted the weightier matters of the law. Now what most people don't notice when they read that is the weightier matters he's going to refer to are also defined by God's law. How do you know when you're exercising true judgment by God's law? What do you know about true mercy? Well, God's law will tell you. What about faith? Just do what God says and believe God. It relates to law. You can't have faith without law, and you can't have judgment and mercy without the law. So Christ's statement to the Jews in his day, he didn't need to say, "Thou shalt tithe all the increase." They'd have said, "Where you been? So what's new? We've been doing that 4,000 years. What do you mean, you shall truly tithe?" You know, you don't need an institution of the Sabbath in the New Testament. You don't need an institution of the laws. They've been in existence from the creation. So when Christ came on the scene in his day, the trouble was they went overboard. They've strained out gnats and swallowed camels. And they get so technical about tithing meant anise and cumin, and yet they don't omit weightier matters, judgment, mercy, and faith. And notice Jesus plainly said, these you ought to have done. You should have been exercising judgment, mercy, and faith. And you shouldn't leave undone tithing meant anise and cumin. But how does the tricky mind get around that? They just say, well, he's talking to Jews, and they were under the old law, so he's telling them they still had to tithe under their old law, since he's talking to Jews. You see, a carnal mind will get around every law of God. You know what Paul meant when he said the carnal mind will not be subject to the law of God. It can't be. It won't be. It'll find some straw to get around what God says. Well, what you think Jesus would have said to the Pharisees, you ought to tithe meant anise and cumin, but my disciples and I don't need to. You ought to, but we don't have to. That's kind of ridiculous. That's kind of weird. You tithe this, and you ought to have done it, not to leave the other undone. You might notice back in Luke 18, here's the Pharisee standing and praying, thanking God for what he's not. Extortioners. Verse 12, he says, I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. Now that's real better translated in some of the other translations. You ought to read what it says in some of the other translations. He's really paying tithes of all that all of his increase. He's paying a tithe of all that he earns, that all that he gains, all that he acquires, he pays tithes on. And that's really what that says. Now, did Christ rebuke this man for paying tithes of all that he earned or gained or acquired? Well, he certainly didn't. Jesus plainly said, as we read to begin with, we should pay back to God what belongs to God. And we should pay back to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Now, I'm not going to read 1 Corinthians 9, but let's notice Hebrews 7, and we'll just quit here with this. Hebrews chapter 7. Now, what's the lesson in Hebrews 7? Well, primarily the fact that the priesthood was changed over from being a physical priesthood in a hereditary line, and now it became a spiritual priesthood. Ministers called by Christ, the head of the priesthood, the Melchizedek, and that the tithing law was transferred over from those physical priests to the spiritual priesthood, the Melchizedek priesthood, for the ministry that Christ called to do the work in this age. That's the lesson that he's getting across here. If you change the priesthood, you change the law, or you transfer the law, as it says. So you transfer the tithe instead of going to Levite and physical priests, it's transferred over to the spiritual priesthood. Abraham gave a tenth part of all, verse 2 says. And he didn't just originate that. He didn't just think that up back when he paid his tithe. You know, most helps you can read on there admit that the way it's worded in the Hebrew, it was a previously known law. Abraham paid a tithe. How great this man was to whom the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. So, verse 2, he gave a tenth of all. And now he paid the tenth of the spoils. And now that same law is transferred over to the spiritual priesthood to carry out the work of God in the New Testament, New Covenant time period. Back there, men that died received tithes. But that law is transferred over now to those that live forever, a spiritual priesthood headed by Christ. Well, I hope we can keep our footing on the truth of God and know that God has inspired Mr. Armstrong to set the doctrines in the church, and as we read there in Acts chapter 2, we're to continue in the apostles' doctrine. And, you know, we're to hold fast the truth that's been shown to us. But we have to be careful because a lot of us can get caught up with a lot of human reasoning and a lot of carnal research. We can get carried away by books that we read into that are written by carnal men that never have had God's Spirit. And that's not the source of coming to the truth. That's not the way you can sort out truth from error. But I hope you can keep yourself grounded in these biblical passages and not let somebody interpret them and lead you right out of God's blessings and promises. You know, we're going to have rough times ahead, and some of us, if we forsake God's tithing laws, we're going to pay a penalty that's going to be really difficult, and we're going to find ourselves right in a time of trouble that we're not going to be able to get out of. So I hope all of us will get behind the work and behind Mr. Armstrong and really do our part in keeping these tithes and paying the tithes.